Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Megan Clougherty. The shootings of the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris last week shocked the world. They also inspired an outpouring of support from journalists and cartoonists who saw the terrorist attack as an assault on freedom of expression. In this special podcast, producer Michael O'Connell interviewed three cartoonists and cartoon editors to get their take on the attacks and their response. Michael Kavanagh is an award-winning cartoonist and editor of the Washington Post's graphic novel column Comic Riffs. In a phone interview with It's All Journalism, he describes the horror that cartoonists across the world felt after the shootings.
You know, it's tough to kind of wrap your arms around the world, which sounds like a U2 lyric. But I, you know, in what we saw in how cartoonists responded in what they draw was you know the horror and the need to respond strongly to the sheer, you know, the level of terror that we're talking about with this massacre. And you know, this isn't, for most cartoonists, this isn't the first time they've felt called to respond to violence against cartoonists in print. I'd say for any veteran cartoonist, while it hasn't been a massacre on this scale, what we've seen with, like, the Syrian cartoonist Ali Firzat a couple years ago, when government forces, according to many reports, were the ones who broke one hand and nearly broke another to intimidate him to not cartoon against the government. And at that time, I wrote an open letter to cartoonists calling for, you know, this is the time for cartoonists around the world to support Ali Firzat because of this kind of intimidation. And, you know, we call it the veto power of violence that bullies are trying to exert. And so what I believe is that cartoonists, especially ones who are affiliated with things like the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists and the Cartoon Rights Network International and National Cartoonist Society, these people have had to respond in the past to this. It's just, you know, once you get over the shock of the level of this, it's like, here we go again. And this has felt like too common a thing since 2005 and when the Muhammad cartoons were first commissioned in the Danish newspaper.
Yeah, I'm looking at the story that you wrote, and you had some, you know, almost in one, speaking in one voice, you have several cartoonists and associations taking a stance on this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Art Spiegelman, the famous mouse artist, you know, cartoonists' lives matter and the right to insult, defame, snigger, and flip the bird ought to be up there with the other four freedoms. And then, you know, you mentioned the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. There was one passage in here that I found particularly, you know, yeah, I agree with this. Furthermore, newspapers should not avoid publishing material from the magazine that allegedly incited the incident. More freedom of expression and not less demonstrates courage in the face of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Shrinking from a newspaper's watchdog role only encourages more terror.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think, you know, you were probably watching the Twitter stream as I was yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and seeing, you know, people in our industry, not just cartoonists, but all types of journalists sort of speaking out against the violence of the acts, but also this attack on the freedom of expression.
Mm-hmm. What I will say is, several years ago, you may remember, it was the television show South Park tried to satirize the Prophet Muhammad, and then they tried to even just depict Muhammad, and Comedy Central, according to many reports, said, no, you're not going to air like that. And that's what resulted in a group called RevolutionMuslim.org is what they went by. They, going through the death of Theo van Gogh in 2004, when he was killed while making a film that had to do with Islamic extremists, to paint it with a broad brush, what that all came forward to is that in this country, that became a flashpoint. You had 17 Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonists support South Park, and then you had the Seattle cartoonist Molly Norris do a cartoon that kicked off what she meant as a campaign called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. Within a couple days, she was spooked by when it went viral, and she ended up at the FBI's guidance going into hiding, changing her name. By the end of that year, I was trading emails with her under her assumed name, and she just said in two words, fatwas suck. So the reason I, that's all prologue to saying, what I saw is that happen was many cartoonists of national and some of global fame, each came to a different point. They each draw their own very individual line about how far they are able to go. You know, is out there as cartoonists, especially, particularly, I should say, political cartoonists like the Bee, they're not all free speech absolutists. But what I saw was some cartoonists are saying, once this happens on this scale, you must publish. You must publish the most provocative cartoons. That is the only way to deal with people who are trying to infringe upon free speech. Publish at all. And as you know, the Washington Post, you had two different editors coming to two different decisions. The executive editor of the Washington Post said, no, we won't just for the sake of doing this. We have our standards, and this doesn't rise to the, you know, past the bar of us changing our standards just for this, whereas you had the editorial page editor saying, no, we should run one. I want to show it. And so on this Thursday, we did run on the editorial pages. We did run a one of the Charlie Hebdo cartoons. So that's a long answer to say cartoonists aren't in lockstep about this, as one might think, but they are more of, you know, they tend to be more of this stance, don't hold me back, let me say what I want to say. But at least in this country, I'll speak in this country, most cartoonists I talk to will say, but I still want to, you know, behave responsibly, but publishers have other things to face. So it's what I'm saying is it's an enormous question. And challenge, but something of this scale, I think it lights a flame under the conversation and puts things into higher relief.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, we do have to recognize the danger that there were people who were killed, that there mm-hmm. are people who are at risk of being harmed for something as simple as drawing and expressing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you could say anything about probably, you know, national or internet or many of the international cartoonists or journalists is that they, you know, they value freedom of expression
mm-hmm.
and they want to be able to have that right as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
as much as they're able to in the society and the standards with which they under which they operate. And, you know, I saw something somebody had posted yesterday, what responsibility does a news outlet have to the journalists who work for them? I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can't just, you know, go off the deep end, as it were, and, you know, be as gung-ho as maybe you might want to be. You have mm-hmm. to take all these other considerations in as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sort of respond in a measured response. So what can we do to promote press freedom, to promote, discourse across the world, satire across the world? Is there anything we can do to sort of spread this message?
Well, I think because now there's a symbol and a hashtag and a slogan, that does goes a long way toward spreading that message. Tackle this in several different layers. On one hand, what I would say is, when it comes to free speech, free expression, First Amendment, you know, we value that so almost above all else as a nation here, to the point that I think my sense talking to just many people in interviews was the Sony hacking scandal with the North Korea regime and everything that was happening. It was serious, and yet people could laugh it off, many people, until it came down to, wait, I don't get to see the interview. I can't go to a theater. I can't press a button on video on demand. I can't see it. It was only once it was reported as a level of death threats,
right.
However veiled. Once that happened, like, wait, you're taking away my choice? at least in the United States, that's when many people responded. Like this, you saw we had a lot of comments on the post site saying, "Hey, this may be a terrible movie. It may be a movie I have zero interest in otherwise, but it's not at that point about the comparative quality of what's on the screen for many people. It's a symbol. It's you're taking away this, and I don't want to create a direct equal parallel between necessarily the interview, where it's, as far as we know, no lives were lost in what happened in Paris yesterday. But what I will say is we react as Americans to, when you take away something, and I think we're seeing that all around the world, when you take away our free speech, our free expression. I think what I'll also point out is, in France, cartoonists are held in general in very high regard. A long history of satirists, going back to Voltaire and Daumier. And so compare that to, occasionally I'll hear someone in this country say, well, it's just a cartoon. Or it's just really a cartoonist, and what would be interesting for me to see is on a sort of a lower or kind of lower level, not one that's perilous, but will the conversation change in America? Will this permanently change how cartoonists are viewed? Because at least in other places in the world, we're reminded of the power of a cartoon in that core visual power that bypasses certain filters in the brain to rouse, to incite, to stir, and you hope to get people to think and feel.
You know, there was a reason the Founding Fathers put freedom of the press as the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that they saw as the most valuable to sustain a free society, and the ability to express yourself and to listen, not even just expressing yourself, but to hear what other people say, even if you disagree with them.
Mm-hmm.
That is core to moving our society, our world forward.
Well, many people would say that Benjamin Franklin was America's first editorial cartoonist with Don't Tread on Me, and the fact that he was the polymath that he was not only a crucial founding father, but also someone who understood the power of a visual to rouse people and unite people and be four words and an image to be a rallying cry of sorts.
So was there any particular cartoon that you saw that came out of this in the aftermath that sort of made you go yes, or made you go yes, that encapsulates what I feel and what I think?
Yeah. It's what cartoonists are working on deadline around the world, obviously, on this, and so often what you see is with many big issues, and we saw this with 9/11, people reaching for, artists reaching for the same familiar symbols. Now, I've written before that I kind of give, for one day, I give a pass to that, because you're working on deadline. You're trying to communicate,
You're a cartoonist. You're working on a quick deadline that you might be used to.
And so I don't discount the power, too, of using those images, because they move people. They almost become requisite in some ways. So we see every possible way you can spin the pen is mightier than the sword idea, and literally, because visually it is so easy to turn a sword into a pen or a gun, or we saw those by the dozens on deadline yesterday, some to varying degrees, varying levels. But to me, one that was more striking, I believe, was David Pope, where it had the body on the ground and had an attacker, and it just said he drew first, the attacker saying it. And it didn't oversell the wordplay, didn't try to do too much. It to me, it pointed the absurdity of someone being, some cartoonist told me yesterday from around the world, saying, called the attackers cowardly and insecure. Well, who looks more insecure than someone that responds to someone with a pencil by wielding a gun? One that was misattributed at times, but and there were variations in the theme. One I liked is just this simple eloquence of a pencil being broken and then coming back two ends sharpened. And that idea, almost in the positive free speech version of the Terminator, where it will come back. And that idea, I guess, speaking to that idea of resilience, many cartoons drew bullets at a drafting table. It's also easy to depict blood as ink and ink as blood. And you can go for power there, especially if you're working just in reds and blacks. But if that's the first cartoon or second cartoon someone's seen, it can have a lot of power. But after, you know, when you're seeing roundups of these in 10, 20, 30, you do look for other things, and that's what I look for in the days ahead, is which commentators, you know, with a pen, reach deeper or probe or push us to think about this and challenge us, you know. But it's a natural progression. Day one, often we unite and we come together, and there needs to be healing. But as we go forward and we learn more, we'll find out. I also should point out as of our discussion on this Thursday, that the two brother attackers, suspects, are still being sought. There's still a manhunt. There's still fear. Will they, that they're heavily armed and will attack again? So, you know, that will, part of it is, this isn't over. This isn't like a few days after the Boston Marathon, you know,
sure,
tragedy or some other tragedies that we've had of anything rivaling this scale, where we kind of, you know, we can kind of begin to move on with information. Here, there's a sustained suspense and just a fear that they will tackle again.
That was Michael Kavanaugh of The Washington Post talking to our producer, Michael O'Connell. Next, Mike interviews Aaron Polgreen over Skype. Aaron is the editor of Symbolia, a digital magazine that blends true stories and illustration to create comics journalism.
My first reaction was just absolute sadness and horror. This is a community that I work with, you know. We publish comics journalism, and I particularly believe in the power of comics journalism to sort of connect with a wide variety of people and hold power to account. One of the things that was troubling to me and that I wanted to write about was the immediate media response was to kind of aggregate and curate all of the work that was coming out on social media from cartoonists, which is, you know, it's part of the ecosystem, and that's part of the role of media organizations, right, is to specifically, you know, provide that filter for their audiences. But these are organizations that don't typically pay cartoonists for their work, and to say, on the one hand, je suis Charlie, and then on the other hand, publish all of this work and not pay anyone for it, that to me felt very against the spirit of the magazine.
Yeah, and it is kind of weird because, I mean, unfortunately, this terrible incident sort of sheds light on comic journalism, and that's maybe not something that a lot of websites are thinking about, and maybe a lot of their readers aren't thinking about. And then suddenly, you know, trying to, you know, jam in as much information as they can and sort of crossing lines that maybe they shouldn't be crossing as far as, like, you know, retweeting and reusing content that cartoonists are creating in response to this is sort of the idea of freedom of expression and acknowledging the power and the work of a comics journalist.
And at the same time, there's also been this sort of controversy over whether or not to publish the offending cartoons. And I find that it is difficult territory to navigate, and each outlet needs to make their own decisions. Of course, there's a great piece in The Guardian about how to do something within your own editorial mandate. Like, the beauty of the digital ecosystem is that, like, you can, if the work isn't available at this one site, like, you can go look somewhere else for it. But I just feel like they're, Charlie Hebdo is a pungent magazine. Like, it's
right,
weird and gross and very visceral. And to not give your readers and your community a chance to experience that and understand, like, the breadth of the conversation, is a real, I think that's a real danger. And I obviously sit on the side of publishing the work.
Yeah, I know, you know, if you think about, you know, just in a wider scheme, the comedians in history, people like Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor, people who, you know, were sort of walking on the edge and had material that was challenging, but, you know, occasionally offensive to people and, you know, certainly not ready for prime time in many ways. But, you know, a lot of times those people who were working in the extremes are the ones who sort of, you know, cross that line and offend people and, you know, sort of move the conversation and the boundaries of what free speech is and what free expression is. They sort of help us to sort of define that area.
Absolutely. And those are the people, like those artists and free thinkers who are working to push those boundaries are often people who do not have full-time jobs. They live contract lives. They provide sort of art for many different clients or work for many different organizations. And they're most at risk and most unprotected when it comes down to actual when the shit hits the fan, basically.
Yeah. You know, just because you support this group, you support this publication, these cartoonists, doesn't necessarily mean you advocate for what their particular position is. So again, you know, that makes it sort of challenging for a news outlet to cover, because, you know, I think it's sort of what you were saying is that you want to show your readers, okay, this is kind of what they're dealing with. And this mm-hmm. is the type of material that they put out there. You know, this is to inform the story, you have to sort of say this is why it was offensive and people reacted to it. That doesn't, you know, justify the violence. It doesn't necessarily justify the content. It's just, you know, sort of explaining what the situation is, just reporting what it is. So what is it that you see that the value, the things that the editorial cartoonists are able to sort of provide to the dialogue of, you know, well, just the public dialogue, the public discourse?
I've spent years studying comics journalism and sort of the role of art in the conveyance of information. For me, comics and cartoons provide this immediate, extremely fast read on a situation. They break down very complex information into its most rudimentary and oftentimes when you're talking about political cartoons, gut level response in the reader. And that's the point. Like, they're trying to invoke an opinion. You know, you can love something or hate something or think something is spot on. But it has provoked you. It has made you like think differently about a subject or at least approach it from a different angle. One of the pieces that I read, and I really wish I could remember where this came from, specifically said that because you can get such a fast read on something visually in so many different cultures, visual work and visual commentary is really a true, like, popular form of media. To eviscerate someone in an op-ed or in text alone means that you are actually shutting out a large number of people from that conversation. And when you reduce things and sort of like simplify them into this very streamlined visual process, that's it's a very powerful thing that can reach many, many more people.
Yeah. You know, in the United States, we have the Pulitzer Prize that they give to editorial cartoonists. Something that may seem odd on its face that you're doing something, people are doing drawings that sometimes people consider, oh, that's, you know, it's like child's work. But the role of the political cartoonist is, you know, has a long tradition. It's something that many people embrace. They may not read the editorial page, but they will look at the editorial cartoons because they like that experience of, you know, the marriage of words and art to sort of express an idea, and you know, seeing that sort of played out on editorial pages, I just think has, you know, just such a profound effect on history. You look at things like, you know, some of the cartoons that happened during the Watergate era. I know this is years before you were around. But there have been other, you know, famous editorial cartoons. Everybody can think of them. When I was talking to Michael Kavanagh for this report, one of the ones that he brought up was the cartoon that somebody had drawn about a pencil being broken, but then, you know, those two pieces being sharpened to create more, you know, two pencils where one was before. Just very simple imagery that sort of conveys a very powerful idea. I think that's one of the strengths of this type of journalism.
You see those ideas get riffed on over and over visually. One of the most powerful things about the work that came out of Charlie Hebdo is that there were those concepts of like the pencil, the pen, like these weapons of mass creation that people really, really played with, and sort of those visual metaphors were able to transcend a lot of cultural boundaries.
Right. And that's, you know, that's another consideration is that even go back to the early days of the newspaper wars around the turn of the 18th and 19th century, where the rise of the American cartoon. And you know, a lot of times that was because a lot of the people who were purchasing the newspaper, a lot of the audience, you know, couldn't read, or you know, were speaking a different language, and the cartoons were sort of an entree into the public discourse. You know, it's sort of a different language, I guess, in our journalistic mission here. Now, people aren't thinking about, you know, cartoons as much, I think, as the newspaper industry is, that as the newspapers are shrinking and so much of our content is being found online. Where do you see cartooning at this point?
That's a great question, and I was hoping you were going to ask it because I wanted to steer the conversation that way.
Okay.
You know, I think the next big boundaries that media organizations are going to face are linguistic, and trying to figure out how to make sure that content bridges English and Spanish and French. And you see those sorts of global initiatives starting to happen at media organizations. Visual journalism, cartoons and comics in particular, are uniquely positioned to translate well across many cultural lines. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more multilingual work in the future.
And is that something that we'll talk a little bit about the publication that you have, Symbolia?
Yeah, so Symbolia is a tablet-focused magazine that publishes six times a year, and we merge journalism and the comic book. So, for example, our next issue, which is coming out very shortly, is focused on the future, and it is specifically looking at things like biometric measurement, 3D printing, terraforming, these sort of big concepts that are going to be really in play in our lifetimes. And we have actually had a lot of success translating our work into other languages and are looking to expand that as well, particularly in French. We published a piece with a Swiss comics journalism startup about the experiences of two female veterans who served at Gitmo, and that really being able to publish that in a couple of different languages and open up the conversation about the experiences of women in the U.S. military, as well as what exactly serving at Gitmo is like. It was a really powerful experience for us.
So why do that in comics journalism? Why not do it in more traditional ways, where do it in text and photos and video and audio? What can comics,
I mean,
bring
absolutely
to-
do it. Absolutely do it in visuals. I think comics are uniquely poised because it's so easy to translate. There doesn't tend to be a lot of text on the page. We tend to sort of instruct our contributors to aim for, like, if you think about page composition, like a third of the page max should include text elements, like two-thirds of it should be visual. So the ability to translate, you're working on a much more sort of granular level, so there's less to actually translate. And you've got that visual aid of what is actually happening in the story that is something that doesn't require translation services. When you're talking about large bodies of texts, you can try automated translation, although, as my friend Hasset Shah likes to say, people aren't idiots. They know when a computer is translating something. But the unique ability of comics, or even working with photos and providing multilingual captions, is really, really powerful. And it's, and it can be really fast once you build up the editorial process to do that.
What do news outlets need to be thinking about going forward with comics journalism? How can they best start incorporating it besides paying for the, you know, the comics that they pull off of Twitter and other places?
Newsrooms should think about the unique needs of their audiences and how to design and deliver content specifically for them. So that may not be traditional editorial cartoons. That may be like a hybrid animated comic that just is one long continuous scroll. It may be something that's a number of panels that are broken up in a responsively designed grid. So when you look at it on different devices, it resizes in a way that makes the reading experience pleasurable, so you're not pinching and zooming on your iPhone. So being really conscious of designing something for the specific reader needs is really important. Just don't be afraid to try something new and throw something at the wall and see if it sticks. It can be pretty easy to turn around like a fun piece in a month, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But experiment above all else.
Yeah, and what's nice about what you're saying is these conversations are going on right now in newsrooms as they're trying to figure out how to package their content to get the biggest bang for the buck on various different platforms, on tablets, on cell phones, on desktops, and you know how to grab readers and how to create content that's interesting, visually stimulating, and different. And you know if in that conversation you say, hey, why not comics? Why not a comic? You know, maybe that's not a bad thing.
It's certainly not a bad thing. And I mean, expand that even further. Why not a game? Why not an interactive landscape that you can like use with either augmented reality or look at doing virtual reality storytelling? This visual space is like, you can do anything.
Yeah.
Do it.
That was Aaron Polgreen, editor of the digital comics magazine Symbolia. Next up, It's All Journalism producer Mike O'Connell talks to political cartoonist Jen Sorensen. She describes the immediate impact the Charlie Hebdo shootings had on the cartooning community.
It is every cartoonist's worst nightmare, and it's absolutely chilling. So just sadness, shock, and horror is how what I was feeling.
So do you feel that this was, you know, as a cartoonist in particular, is this not necessarily that they were targeting cartoonists per se, but you know they were targeting a magazine that was sort of famously satirical cartoons.
Yeah, I mean it definitely I would say is an attack on cartooning, and you know I certainly you know I feel terrible for the victims, as you know we're all kind of members of the tribe, the cartooning tribe, and I guess you know, as far as my responsibilities were concerned, like immediately I had to leap into action and, you know, I had to start gathering cartoons for a roundup on Fusion, which is a website I'm now working for as a comics editor. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but we have a section called Graphic Culture where I've been publishing a lot of comics and mostly sort of socially conscious cartoons and comics. And so I immediately just had to, I mean, spend that whole day contacting cartoonists around the world, trying to get permission to run their cartoons. And because I thought that was important, you know, on such a day, like a lot of websites were just grabbing cartoons, grabbing tweets, like BuzzFeed just embedding tons and tons of tweets from cartoonists, I presume without their permission. And I just don't think that's right, especially on a day like that, when we should be respecting cartoonists.
Yeah, respecting them as not only artistic people, but also people who are professionals who are doing this work as their livelihood.
Exactly. And some people are giving their cartoons away for free because, you know, this is a special circumstance and they just want to get their work out there. And I completely respect that. But I think it's very important to at least ask permission first and, you know, offer to pay if you can. And that's what we were doing on Fusion. And so for me, it was just like, of course, it's a lot harder to do that. And so it was a very, very long day of just emailing people and scouring the web, and pretty intense. But I'm really happy with the result in the end. Like, I'm really proud of our little roundup that we did.
Well, how did cartoonists respond to the attacks? And then how did they respond to the requests from you to, you know, incorporate their work into what you were doing?
Well, I'd say, you know, cartoonists all over the world, I mean, everywhere, you know, out, even outside the U.S., I've spoken with Muslim cartoonists, and, you know, every single one I've heard from is condemning the attacks. And so I'd say cartoonists are pretty unanimous in that regard. In terms of me contacting people directly, there's some people that we are kind of set up, you know, we offered everyone payment, and, you know, some situations, you know, we definitely, like, payment is expected. There are a few other cartoonists who said, go ahead, you can just use it. It's easier that way. Just link back to my, you know, my newspaper or my, you know. So, but you know, everyone was very, you know, everyone responded positively and wanted me to use their cartoons.
How did you respond as an artist? You sort of described what you did as an editor. You sort of wanted to aggregate some of this material and put it together as sort of a response. Have you thought about maybe how you're going to respond to it?
Well, you're talking to me on my deadline day, and I still am thinking about what I'm going to do, so I'm under a little bit of stress right now. I think that I will say, like, one area where I probably depart a little from my colleagues, and this is, you know, I've just been thinking about this for days now and trying to sort my thoughts on paper. And, you know, I think that we can absolutely blame the terrorists who did this. It is their fault. No one should ever be harmed for expressing an opinion, no matter what they're saying. We should respond with words and pictures, not violence. So, you know, I do not blame the cartoonists for this act, you know, for this attack.
Because of the outrageousness or alleged outrageousness of whatever
right.
they were doing.
However, I think that we can also hold in our heads at the same time the understanding that, you know, I think maybe these cartoons, they weren't helping the situation. I think we can be free to criticize the cartoons themselves at the same time that we utterly condemn the attacks by the terrorists. And because there's a lot of people, they're just sort of shouting anyone down who even attempts to talk about the cartoons or try to understand their place in French society. And, you know, I would say that the cartoons did kind of punch down at France's Muslim immigrant community. I think maybe the cartoonists themselves didn't realize how, you know, they were arguing against radical, you know, violent extremists. But I think, you know, the message of those cartoons also were not nice to the oppressed minority in France. And so I feel like, you know, we can point out both of these things. And I feel like maybe some of my colleagues just, they're unwilling to even say that or go that far. But, you know, like this attitude that we have to publish all these cartoons in, like, all these American newspapers or the terrorists have won, I just don't see that as proving anything, you know? Like, I see the impulse there, but, I just think it's counterproductive. And, you know, the attitude, like, I'll show them, that just seems so Bush era to me. You know, like, that's just not that's not the response I'm feeling. I just feel sad, and, you know, I think that there are constructive ways to respond to it, like donating money to a nonprofit called the Cartoonist Rights Network International, which actually does great work saving cartoonists around the world from persecution. I mean, there are so many cartoonists in the Middle East and South Africa, to name a couple places that are really, I mean, facing death threats and just harassment from their governments and all sorts of things that they really need some help from the cartooning community. And that is one real concrete way people can help.
Do you see this unfortunate event as sort of shining light on something that people may not be aware of, that there are cartoonists around the world who are being oppressed?
You know, it's funny. I mean, I hope it does. But, you know, this stuff has been going on for a long time. You know, Doa El Adel is a Egyptian cartoonist who I met, actually, when she came to the United States on a State Department tour. And, you know, her life was threatened by the Morsi regime these people are doing, like, they're not even trying to be blasphemous. I mean, they're just doing intelligent work. And you know, to me, like, this is the real, I don't know. I wish we would pay as much attention to the rights of these cartoonists who are dealing with this stuff every day, and no one really seemed to care about before now. I mean, obviously, we need to pay attention to what happened in Paris. But I hope it does shine a light on the heroic work that all these cartoonists around the world are doing that no one really cares about. Their seems to care about their free speech.
Yeah, and it seems
for very few people.
Very few people. It seems also that when we talk about free speech, that people aren't always immediately thinking about cartooning and sort of including that in there. I mean, there's been a long tradition in the United States for editorial cartooning, and people sort of respond to that, I think, and sort of respect that. But they don't always think about that maybe in the same way as they do about, press freedom and, people like rap songs that have offensive language or something else where people get into these arguments about free speech. They're not necessarily thinking about cartoons.
That's true. I mean, it seems like people only think about cartoons when there's some kind of extremely negative reaction to them. So it's unfortunate. We're like, cartoonists are almost always in the news when something terrible happens or when someone has drawn something very controversial. And, at the same time, I mean, people are reading them all the time, and we're getting more and more traffic each year, as far as I can tell. But because they're great on social media, they get lots of shares, but you only hear about us when something bad happens.
Were there any particular cartoons that you saw over the last few days that sort of you thought really kind of encapsulated the situation for you, or that you really were like, hey, this is right on. This is, this sort of expresses things that I feel.
Yeah. And I tried to run them all on our roundup on Graphic Culture. I guess a couple that come to mind first are, Ted Rall had a really strong cartoon about American newspapers saying, gosh, I hope this sort of shooting doesn't happen here. And someone's like, well, it won't, because we fired our cartoonist. It was actually, the wording was better than that. But, it does show how, it's kind of sad. I think there's only 50 cartoonists left and staff cartoonists in the United States, and down from roughly, I think over 200 from maybe a couple decades ago. There's some debate among cartoonists, like exactly how many there were at their peak, but let's just say there's not nearly as many left. And actually, there's another cartoon by a Brazilian cartoonist named Carlos Latuff, whose work I hadn't seen before, but it just shows the terrorists shooting through the Charlie Hebdo offices into the top of a mosque, and I just thought that was a very clever use of layout and imagery, very, very smart cartoon.
A lot of the same symbolism seem to be sort of popping up. We're just speaking strictly as sort of a critic of the stuff coming. A lot of broken pencils, ink pots and things like that. Cartoonist community pulling together their collective symbolism, perhaps, and sort of trotting
well, I guess, the thing, okay, every media outlet in the country wanted cartoons immediately about this. And, I think the first cartoons that you're going to see are going to be fairly simple single-panel cartoons. And, yes, a lot of those involve pens and pencils, and some of them were very, artfully rendered. I guess, and we included some of those in our roundup, too. But I guess, the cartoons that interest me most are ones that maybe shed a bit more complexity on the issue. And, like Joe Sacco had a really interesting comic in The Guardian. I don't know if you saw that. I don't know how he cranked that out so fast. It's pretty ornate. But, just a little more. When you have multiple panels, I think it allows you to complicate the issue a little bit more. And, I guess the pens and pencils were a fine first reaction, but I'm sort of looking forward to seeing what is going to come in the days ahead.
A more thoughtful, a more second day look at it, second, third day look at it. Is your next weekly cartoon going to be addressing this theme, do you think?
Yes, I'm still figuring out what I'm doing, but I think that one way or another, yes, it will be on this topic for sure.
That was political cartoonist Jen Sorensen talking about the reaction of the cartooning community to the Charlie Hebdo shootings. You can find the links to Jen's cartoons and other cartoons and articles mentioned in this podcast at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.